I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove. And with us today are Emma Fraser, a freelance writer. She's sort of focused on costume design, pop culture. She wrote for Little White Lies, Collider, and Vulture. And Tori Brevetti, a co-host of the podcast, The Best of the Americans, the Rewatch podcast. I would say that if you are a fan of Carrie Russell or Matthew Rhys, these are the people to be following. thank you so much for being here today, guys. This is a little bit of a weird episode, and I'm excited to dive into all of the Rolling Stone covers of 1999. We will be talking about all of them, but it will surprise no one that some of them will not get as much of our attention as others. But I want to start a little bit by rewinding and seeing where you guys were in 1999. Tori, I'm assuming, was learning how to walk as a toddler or something along those lines. But where were you guys in 1999?
Emma?
Okay. Well, I was 16, so I had already learned how to walk. And it was a big year for me. I went to Glastonbury for the first time, which was wild.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, like, full-on crazy experience. Saw R.E.M. My friend got on stage with Hole. Courtney Love gave her her guitar, which, I know.
That's fucking crazy.
I know. So there's this really, like bad picture of me, like, on the last day of the festival, on the bus, on the way home, with the guitar. So that's probably my highlight of 1999.
I mean, that's a serious fucking highlight of 1999. As I don't know if you guys, I mean, have listened to previous episodes, but Kenny and I, my co-host, we were just huge fans of Courtney Love in 1999. 200 Cigarettes and Man on the Moon. She was almost, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on Helena Bonham Carter's character's name? Marla Singer in Fight Club.
Yeah.
She was just like, there was a real moment, and it's a shame that Courtney Love didn't act really anymore.
Yeah.
Because she was pretty fantastic. But yeah, that's, I mean, Jesus, that's a hell of a 99. That's pretty great.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have much else to talk about. But no, I was just started drinking and, like, hanging out, you know, sure. Being 16.
Being 16, yeah. Being 16 to 99, I mean, it's a good time. And Tori, what about you?
I mean, I was also drinking.
Do you remember anything from 99, Tori?
Not much, not much. Okay. In 1999, I was 4 years old.
Sure, sure. So, like, you're probably watching, I'm assuming, like, Teletubbies, probably?
Yep, like, everything on PBS was my jam.
Sure.
I was killing it in preschool.
We have a little bit of Teletubbies on the Britney Spears cover of Rolling Stone we're talking about as well. Yeah, so you
But, I was a huge Britney fan, like, even at this age, literally, like, the following year in 2000, I went to my first concert ever, Britney Spears, for my birthday.
Whoa.
Wow.
August 2000. I was 5 years old. I went to see Britney Spears.
That's so cool.
That's crazy.
I did fall asleep.
Sure, sure.
But I went. But I mean,
that's got to be like, at five, that's a pretty immense, like, visual kind of, like, experience. I'm sure I would have gone to sleep, too. I would be like, I can't process all of this. I'm going to sleep.
But, yeah, I remember waking up, and she was floating in the sky, like, as an angel. Like, that's my visual memory of this. Did I die?
That's fantastic. I'm trying. My first concert was a far less exciting one. I think I saw Natalie Cole with my parents. I think that was my first concert, sadly. But I mean, not sadly, but it is what it is. But yeah, that's wow. That's Britney Spears' first concert. That's a good one. Yeah,
she was my everything.
Yeah, well, she's still a lot of people's everything, quite honestly. I mean,
true.
It's a real shame that she can't apparently be an individual based on the law. But I mean, other than that, it's been a weird. One of the things about the pandemic that I thought was funny or interesting, I guess, is. Britney seems to have been living in a quarantine for the past like 20 years. So for her, she's just like, guys, this is not a big deal.
Nothing's different.
She burnt down her gym. That was the gym moment where she was like, burn down my gym.
Britney's had, I mean, you could do just a podcast on Britney Spears and get like 200 episodes easy out of Britney Spears. But we did do an episode, and when we get to Britney's cover, we'll talk about this more specifically. But we did do an episode on Baby One More Time in its entirety. And, well, it's got like some bangers for sure, but like as an album, doesn't really hold together particularly well. But yeah. It's crazy, but we'll talk about that. So I just want to give a touch of context for the people that are living under a rock and don't know that Rolling Stone magazine exists. But it was founded in San Francisco in California, 1967 by Jan Wenner and music critic Ralph J. Gleason, first known for his coverage of rock music and its political reporting by the infamous Hunter S. Thompson. In the 1990s, the magazine broadened and shifted its focus to a younger readership interested in youth-oriented television shows, film actors, popular music. It since has returned to more of a traditional mix of content, including music, entertainment, and politics. It's got a current total circulation of a little over 700,000. It's interesting how, and I don't know if you, this is total like nerdy shit, but I got bummed out when they shrunk their dimensions.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I have weirdly both sizes right next to me, and it's depressing. Like, because I am a magazine nerd, and the same thing happened to NME over here. It went from newspaper to magazine, and then that was kind of the death knell in a weird way, because obviously as it was trying to change, and now it's just digital.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, magazine culture. We've talked a lot as a culture, as pop culture, about the death of books, quote unquote, even though I just personally just bought a bunch of tactile books for the first time in a while. And I was like, oh, books are great. Like holding on to something is great. And we never really talked about the death of magazines necessarily because they still sort of exist. Like magazine culture still exists. But I guess my question to you guys is, how much longer do you think it will exist for? It's tough when I look at like the magazines that I grew up on. Entertainment Weekly, for instance, was a big magazine for me as a kid. And now it's just digital. I get a little pop up on my iPad when there's a new issue to flip through. It doesn't have the same, I don't know, power that it used to have, but I guess some still exist. It feels like fashion magazines still exist in a pretty significant way.
Yeah, and I found this year particularly, I already subscribed to a bunch of things anyway. And actually, just before the pandemic started, I started a subscription to The New Yorker. I'd subscribed in the past and then just done the free trial. But then I started again, and it's actually been weirdly nice having this kind of collection of this awful year, which sounds weird, but to have it like preserved in print. And like, and then seeing how like things like Vanity Fair and Vogue were pivoting during all of this, like, so at home shoots, like shooting stuff over Zoom. And I found this year to be really invigorating in the magazine industry. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to help long term, but I think it's just like shown how powerful they can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, Tori, I'm very curious about your thoughts on this too, since you're of a different generation.
Yeah.
How do you feel about tactile versus, there was a whole New York Times article about how your generation, and I promise I won't use that term anymore, but that younger people have turned back to what they call tangibles.
Yeah. It's weird because I moved away from tangible things, I guess. More in high school, like I had a Kindle and stuff like that, but now I'm always buying books, but not magazines. I have a lot of digital subscriptions, but I don't like having stuff because you read through it once and you're like, what am I supposed to do with this? That's kind of my thought process.
Behind Emma is a giant bookshelf of books and magazines.
Well, books is different because I reread books all the time, but magazines, it's like, I could just Google this article if I really wanted to read it again. My thought process.
That's true.
I was going to say, I have this really weird thing as well. So if there's like an article that everyone's like sharing, but I know it's going to be in the print, I'm like, I'm going to wait and read it in the print. So I might miss out. Yeah. It's this weird like thing that I do. Obviously, if it's like something like the one that like landed today on Elle, like I'm going to read that shit straight away.
Like inject that into your veins the second that it's out in the world. Yeah.
If it's something more like a longer read, I'll probably wait until the print arrives. So it's just
we're not going to go off on this Martin Scorsese thing because it's really not worth too much of our time. But the fact that she has a Twitter account and is replying to people on Twitter today, I'm just like, what are you doing?
I haven't even dove into
it's
that.
A lot. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
The Twitter part.
It's intense. But I do think, you know, it's funny you say that, Tori, about how you don't own the magazines or feel the need to own the magazines, which I sort of understand. At the same time, as I was doing sort of a deep dive into Rolling Stone covers yesterday, I did find myself thinking back on like specifically, I remember that Smashing Pumpkins issue of Rolling Stone and how much I oddly like treasured it in a weird way. Like there's something about the fact that you feel like you own a piece of it, which is fucked in its own way. And I completely think that there's something messed up about it, but you want a piece of it. Like you want a piece of this moment. And I think magazines, unlike books and unlike most things, really do sort of freeze a moment in ember. And I think that that's kind of interesting. I don't know how many magazines I'd want to own from my past, but there's a couple that I kind of wish I still had. I have a couple.
I got rid of loads when we got this unit, and I was like literally sorting through them, being like, right, okay, which covers might end up being worse stuff. So like, I kept things like Casey on the cover because I was like, I'm sure this will sell, maybe, but probably not. You know what I mean? I was like, and Taylor, I was like, so things with like fan bases, I was like, right, if I keep this one, it might be an investment. It's probably going to go for like £5, but
I didn't figure out so you guys did way more research than me. I'm going to just be completely above board and say that you guys did way more research than me. But do you guys know who has been on Rolling Stone cover the most times? Because I wasn't able to find that.
No. I didn't look that up.
Because I feel like Taylor's been on it at least 3 or 4 times is my guess. And my assumption is that someone's probably been on it more.
I can tell you how many. Britney, in the space of 10 years or 9 years, was on it like about 8 times. There was one year where there was a couple of years where she was on it twice. So the year, I have this one here.
Britney returns. Many returns.
Yeah. So that year, there was in the February, it was basically the like Britney's like downfall cover. Inside an American Tragedy was the title. and then the Britney returns. But before that, so there was the 99, 2000, twice in 2001, 2002, 2003, and then 2008.
That's, so, I mean, yeah, she might be the one who's been on it the most. I'm speculating.
Kurt Cobain, maybe?
The Beatles as individuals or a band have been over 30. And then Madonna.
Oh,
wow.
Oh yeah.
Okay, that tracks. That makes complete sense. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how, and I guess I want to sort of talk for a second about magazine covers in general, because I feel like there are some that, for whatever reason, just burn in your brain that you're just like, I remember that cover. They tend to be pop culture stuff for me. I imagine they're far more important things for other people, but it's just like Yesterday, I posted on Twitter a handful of magazine covers that I remember, but also that Gossip Girl cover, I remember it vividly because I was just like, this is not okay. Like, these women are quite young. You're infantilizing them with ice cream, but it's...
I have that issue.
Sexualized. That one will sell. But it's like, I would also say too, like, it was part and parcel of the Gossip Girl marketing campaign by and large, which was obviously tapping into younger audiences, and sort of the audacity of the show was really kind of writ large. But are there covers that you guys remember? Maybe it doesn't even need to be Rolling Stone, but just like covers that you remember as an adolescent that sort of like imprinted you in some way?
Yeah, I've got a few, mostly relating to the X-Files. So the X-Files Rolling Stone cover, like, I wrote a piece on it last year. Gillian Anderson had posed for FHM a couple of months before in her underwear. And I remember being like 13 and just a little bit confused because I was like, you know, I was just used to her in this suit. And I was like, this is cool, I think. Or am I meant to be offended because she's in her underwear? And then they did the Rolling Stone one, which was both of them in bed. And then I was like, no, this is cool.
So. Hold on just one second. Emma, I seem to have lost. Now you're back. You're back.
Cool. Oh.
Can you hear me?
I lost you, but now I can
hear you.
Can
you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
We're fine.
Cool.
All of that recorded, I think. But will you just repeat for me? I was a little confused, and then that's
Okay. So yeah, I was a little confused about like this cover and have like Scully being so sexualized, because in the show she really wasn't. It was pretty chaste. Obviously, in the pilot you see her in her underwear, but it's like not a sexy scene as such. And then yeah, the Rolling Stone cover happened, and it was both of them. And I don't know why, because it was the two of them. I was like, this is way more empowering, and also because I maybe had a crush on David Duchovny.
Interesting. Sure.
And
sure.
I wanted them to be together in the show. So it was kind of hot. So yeah.
I mean, sure, you and everyone else that watched the show. And then Chris Carter got into the action as well in that issue as well, right?
So yeah. And know, he's really weird in the story as well. He's very specifically like, this is not Mulder and Scully. He's like, anyone who thinks this is Mulder and Scully in bed, it's not. Like, he was really weirdly like prudish about people like maybe like writing fan fiction about this cover.
I mean, first of all, like, let people have what they want to have,
right?
Like, just be happy that there's fans that want your characters to hook up. I do think it's interesting. He was the way he tried to sculpt the perception of their relationship is pretty groundbreaking in a lot of ways, in the sense that the pushback against them being romantically involved, I think is really interesting. That being said, I think it goes wildly off the rails near the end when like they're having children that aren't, like, they didn't have sex. They had to have like a test tube baby. Like, it's all just like, it's all crazy. So
let them fuck is all I'm saying.
Exactly.
I binge watched the show, so I can't even imagine watching it in real time.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
Torture. Sounds like torture.
That's incredible.
It really was.
were there covers for you, Tori, that you remember?
I mean, I would say the Britney one, the Rolling Stone one. I don't know if I remember it in 99, sure. But as a fan of Britney, just around that time, I remember that cover. That's the one.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because it feels like that cover, there are certain covers that send like shockwaves through pop culture, and that's just one of them. And we'll get to it in sequence, but it is really, it's really kind of fascinating as to why it was such a big deal, but we'll get to that. Yeah. I mean, I think that, this feels like as good an opportunity as any to start going through them chronologically. For our listeners, we're going to post all of the images on Twitter and on Instagram. So, and we will describe them obviously as well as we talk about them. I love that you're drinking a martini right now. That is tremendous. Emma just took a sip of a martini in the classiest, most British. It was fantastic. We will talk about we'll describe them, but if you want to follow along or if you want to know what we're talking about, obviously just Google Rolling Stone 1999 covers. But the first cover in January is the Beastie Boys. You know, do you guys have thoughts on the Beastie Boys? Are you fans?
Yeah, I like them.
Yeah. I like them. I mean, when I think of the Beastie Boys, I think of like the 80s. So when I saw them as Artist of the Year in 1999, I was like, okay.
are you not a fan of Hello Nasty? Their
no,
album
I know Intergalactic, but that's it. Right.
fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I will say that there are a handful of people on these covers. I think there are 26 or 27 of them in total over the course of 99. And there are a couple head scratchers of people that you're like, this, you had a list and this person was not on the top of it and you couldn't get the other people. So such and such. I don't think the Beastie Boys fall into that category by any means, but, They are artists, a band, however you want to describe them, that I was not really into as a kid. I had friends that were very big fans of them. They were obviously trendsetters. They broke all sorts of barriers in terms of white guys rapping, I guess is the best way to put it. I mean, like they just really kind of like broke open the genre. And I recently watched the Spike Jonze documentary on Apple TV, which I thought was pretty interesting in terms of how can I put this, starting off as kind of douchebags and then deciding we don't want to be douchebags, we want to be good people, and we want to learn and grow and change. That's a rarity in music. So that should be commended. But what do you guys think of this cover in particular though?
I mean, I have to admit, when it comes to the Rolling Stone covers with the kind of musicians on the front, I'm less like, depending, obviously the Britney cover is different, but like most of the musician covers, I read a lot of the profiles, but a lot of the musician ones I kind of skipped because it's just like, I like it, but I prefer just listening to the music rather than necessarily reading about whatever like situation the profiler has them in. Is like kind of my take.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I would tend to agree with you that musicians talking about making music isn't always the most interesting thing in the world.
Yeah.
It depends on the artist. I think that, you know, my favorite artists, you know, Bjork is my number one. I adore Bjork. The way she talks about the sort of the artistic process, what, you know, sort of the intellectualizing of all the stuff she's doing, those type of artists I find really interesting. It's not to say that the Beastie Boys aren't interesting necessarily, but I hear your point, Emma, that musicians talking about music is kind of like, you know, yeah, it's not always that interesting. I also got to say too, like, I get the whole like fisheye lens thing that they're going for on this cover, which was very much of the time. I feel like every fucking music video was shot with a fisheye lens. So I get it. But it's just not that interesting, but it is what it is.
Yeah,
the second one is Rob Zombie, a polarizing figure, to say the least. But, you know, he's one of those guys that, I remember Dracula. I mean, who doesn't? A classic. It appears in The Matrix, or there's a needle drop of it in The Matrix, which might be one of his lasting legacies. I found him kind of endearing in a weird way. He seemed like not like he was going for this like I'm scary thing, but like he really seemed kind of like a nice guy. I don't know.
It's weird with Rob Zombie. I guess like my biggest interaction with him has been like I've seen some of his movies that he's directed. In terms of the music, I probably couldn't name you a song. So sorry, Rob Zombie.
I mean, I don't know what Rob Zombie's real name is. I hope it's just Rob Zombie, but. But I it is interesting. He did sort of he got out of the music game and got into movies, and he made a lot of sort of pulpy B horror films, I guess is sort of the best way to describe it. I'm not a horror person, so that's just not really my bag. Tori, do you have thoughts on Rob Zombie?
I mean, my only real knowledge of him was like his Halloween movie. Which is not good to me.
But
I read the article, the profile on him, and I had the same thought where it's like, he seems like a really nice guy.
Like he seems like a smart, nice guy.
Yeah.
Just like this is the persona I'm going to run with. And it's more of a sort of a performative thing than it is mm-hmm. like anything else. And I remember at the time I had a friend or still have this friend who was kind of just like, this seems kind of kitschy and I'm into it. Like it seems kind of funny and winky. But then when he went full on horror, I don't know. There's just something very sort of like the message is muddled is right. Kind of what it gets, is where I'm coming from. That being said, this cover. That's Rob Zombie. I really don't know what else to tell you other than that Rob Zombie's on the cover.
I like his cuff. He's got a nice cuff on. That's fun. So yeah, good cuff.
Good cuff. I kind of dig the, I'm not a fan, generally speaking, I don't love tattoos generally. I don't know. It depends on what you're saying with them. I feel like if you're just kind of, but these are cool tattoos. I'm into it.
A lot of text on
them. number three is Lauryn Hill, who had obviously a very big 1998 with The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, one of the best albums, full stop, ever. I mean, it's a tremendous piece of art, and it's a bummer she didn't make more of them. But she's got stuff. I don't really know what to make of this cover, quite frankly. It doesn't really feel very Lauryn Hill to me. But what do you guys think?
I mean, I was going to say, she looks like a puppet. Like, she looks like a marionette. Like, someone's, like, waiting to pull her strings the way she's, like, hunched.
I don't like that she's cut off on the top and the bottom. It's like she's, like, squished into the cover. Like, she's, like, trying to...
I totally agree with you.
Also,
I hate the dimensions.
The juxtaposition of, so, Lauryn Hill, like, being the cover star, then with pretty fly white rappers who don't suck. Like, why do we have to have Lauryn Hill and white rappers? Like, it seems
like that. I fully agree with you.
And I don't know who any of those white rappers are besides Eminem. So I
don't. Who are the other ones? Can you?
Everlast.
Okay, yeah.
Sure. And Remedy.
Oh,
no. Don't know that one. Well, and also Pretty Fly feels like is it a reference to the Offspring song, or am I crazy? Am I making that up? Is that later? Pretty Fly for a White Guy? Is that?
I feel like that's later, but
I feel like it's later too. So this cover to me feels a little bit, I don't really know how to explain it other than the fact that she's really hunched over, so we can't even really get a really good look at her outfit, which seems to be a little varsity-esque, like high school varsity. Yeah. Something or other, but she's wearing heels, which are, as Tori mentioned, also cut off. Her beautiful hair is also cut off. It's all just very strange. And also doesn't really, like, okay, so I'm going to read into this a little bit. Is the varsity supposed to be because the name of the album is Miseducation of Lauryn Hill? Perhaps. I don't know if this is some sort of a commentary on education. I don't know. But none of this feels like the album or the persona with which she had created. So right. It's all a little bit of a head scratcher.
Also, another quick thing about the cover lines. How Sugar Ray appeared on two covers in a row. They're on the Rob Zombie one, and then this one, and then he gets his own
cover. And then he gets another fucking cover. I think it's like Next, if I'm not mistaken. Mark McGrath was having a moment. Sugar Ray is also one of those bands, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit more specifically when we get to his cover, is like they were like a punk band. They were like this like hardcore punk band, and then they were like, you know what?
Really?
Let's totally sell the fuck out and become like I don't even know how you describe them. They're kind of like ska. I don't know. I really don't know. But this cover, I feel, does not do justice to one of the greatest musicians to come out of the 90s. But I mean, that's what happened. Number four is a big one.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston. On the cover, talking about, now you guys can talk about this because I did not read this article.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
I'd really love to talk about this article because I feel like there's some good gossip in it, I assume.
Oh my god.
This is, so it's interesting. My crush on Friends was Monica. What that says about me, I don't know. In terms of her personality, in terms of what have you. Obviously, Jennifer Aniston was enormous in the 90s. I mean, yeah. It was, you know, Rachel Green was an enormous figure on television and in pop culture. And then she marries Brad Pitt. And it's just like, it becomes sort of next level. All of this being said, she never fully has a breakout career in features. Like, she never really has a big movie career. She has a couple hits here and there, but those hits all tend to be with her just being sort of the sidekick to some big comedic star like Jim Carrey or what have you, where you're just like, you're better than this, and it's unfortunate that you're being saddled with this type of stuff. I love Jennifer Aniston. I think she's tremendously talented, and yet at the same time, I feel like she never, as huge as she was in the 90s, I feel like she never became, you know, Reese Witherspoon or whatever sort of name you want to sort of, you know, whatever it is, Julie Roberts, what have you. What are your thoughts on this cover and this outfit where she looks like she's a magician's assistant?
That's a weird choice. But do you know, I don't know if you looked up her previous cover. So she did the Friends group shot, yes, and then she was on the cover in 96, and she's butt naked. Like,
is that the one where she's lying on the bed, yes, and it's just her ass? Yeah.
Yeah, and you can see like her little thong tan line, and it's, and obviously, if I look like Jennifer Aniston, I would also probably do that. And the thing I do like about Rolling Stone in a weird way is that the nudity is kind of equal opportunities. There's often as many like naked men. I mean, there's probably more naked women, but it's not like the men are always clothed. But it's interesting that she went from that to the circus assistant. Like, it's an odd choice.
I don't get it. Tori, what do you think?
This pose, it looks like they caught her like mid switching poses. Like, she.
Yeah, it looks like she's like, yeah. It's all very confusing. She doesn't look particularly happy either. Like, she looks caught in a, to your point, Tori, she looks like she's been, I don't know, pestered a bunch, and they just, this is the best that they could have. I don't know. It's very strange. So in 99, she's married to Brad Pitt.
Engaged. They get married. Okay. They get married in 2000. Sorry, I looked it up because
please.
He's very coy in his later one about whether when they're getting married. And the whole interview is literally about her parents' divorce. And then if you read the 96 interview, that's also about her parents' divorce. Like, it's very odd.
So she's still processing her parents' divorce?
Oh, they're just trying to, like, it's, the second one is very therapy-like. It's a woman interviewer whose name I did have and I now seem to have lost. She also interviewed Nicole Kidman, and that is also, like, therapy.
Oh my god, the Nicole.
I mean, the Nicole one, I cannot fucking wait to get to that. But yeah, the problem ultimately with both of these women, ultimately, Nicole, I would say as well, is they're defined by their partners as opposed to being defined by who they are. Which, I mean, listen, it's still happening today. It's hopefully happening less. But back then, it feels like female famous
can I,
people.
Can I read a bit from, like, just a sentence? Please, please. The classic description. So, you know, you got to add color. You got to say what they're wearing, blah, blah, blah. Anison, wearing no makeup, is dressed in Levi's 501s and a tomato-colored T-shirt. But there's no hiding her spectacular figure. Like, I mean, obviously, okay. People want to cool. know that stuff, but it's like, Jen's the girl next door, but she's really hot.
Yeah. It's like that. It's become a trope now, but in screenplays, the beautiful, but she doesn't know it,
yeah,
which is a character description for every female character that you see. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's, but yeah, I think that they definitely are trying to, that's kind of like the previous cover, the one where she's lying on the bed, is a lot more of the girl next door, but like naughty, I guess, is sort of what they're kind of going for. This is, I guess I mean, ultimately it's going for something that's sort of splashy and surprising and, you know, bold, I guess, which, you know, it should be said, in 99, the only film she has, and it's a great one, is Office Space. Yeah. And she's great in that movie. And you see that sort of, her using those muscles again, you know, in the breakup and in other sort of The Good Girl and in other sort of like off the beaten path a little bit or weirder movies. So I do, you got to wonder, like, I don't know. I don't know Brad Pitt. I'm sure he's lovely. But like, how is that a good idea for your career?
Yeah, and it's annoying as well because on her cover, Brad is positioned. Like, she's Brad's girl, whereas on his cover, even though she's referenced a lot in the interview, her name is not mentioned at all. And it's really... On the cover, yeah, it's really telling that it's like, this is Brad, and then here it's like, Brad and Jen.
Yeah, this is also one of those Rolling Stone covers as well, where all of these other things that are listed on here are so random and just sort of like, so I'll just read them for our listeners. Spring Break, Survival Guide to Beaches, Bars, Bods, and Bands. Then you've got Limp Bizkit, The Roots, Stones Tour, Jesse the Body Ventura, Mel Payback Gibson, Young Actors on the Verge, and Clinton's Reefer Madness, More Pot Bust Than Nixon. And you're just like, what is this magazine? Like, what is it? It is so scattershot in terms of what it's trying to be. But listen, I guess back in the day, you could sort of do that. I don't know.
I have
a
little for the Young Actors on the Verge. Do you guys have any idea who they might be talking about? Like, I have the list, but do you have any guesses?
It's all five guys.
Of course it's five guys. I'm gonna guess one.
Okay.
Is Wes Bentley one of them?
No.
That was my guess.
I was trying to think, what is Josh Hartnett one of them?
Yep.
Yes.
He was on the verge his entire career.
That's why it made me laugh. I was like, Josh Hartnett, of course. Okay.
Scott Speedman. Is Scott Speedman on there?
Scott Speedman is on the list. Wow. Okay. Diego Serrano, who I've never heard of.
Who, sorry?
That is.
Diego Serrano?
No.
No.
Scott Wolf.
Right.
Sure.
And finally, Jim Caviezel.
Interesting.
Also with the Mel Gibson on the cover. Like, that's
I mean, Passion of the Christ is right around the corner, so I guess maybe that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, Josh Hartnett, I feel like someone needs to write a book about all the, like, buzzy people. Like, people that, like, the almost... the people that got like really close and are famous. Like, let's be real. Josh Hartnett is famous. Like, he's not famous, but he's not, what they thought he was going to be.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Payback, by the way, is also like a fraught experience for Mel Gibson. It's definitely, it's a weird movie, which we've covered on the podcast. We liked it. Sort of. It's got a lot of problems.
I've not seen it.
I've never seen
it. It's written and directed by Brian Helgeland, who is probably most known for his Academy Award winning co-writing of LA Confidential. He sort of had like a really kind of big moment in the 90s, and he wrote and directed A Knight's Tale, everyone's favorite Heath Ledger movie where he plays a jouster. Is that what that's called?
I think so.
It is what it is. So it's a strange thing. Clinton also on here in a I don't know, a dying moment of his presidency, in the last year of his presidency anyway. I mean, he's just been impeached in January. So there, that happened. Are there any other bits in that interview that we should talk about in terms of Jennifer or? Are we good?
They just keep talking about how Brad Pitt's making her extra radiant. That's one of the other things I have down. Allison's extra radiance these days has been credited to Pitt, 35.
Oh, fuck that.
And she avoids like every Brad question too.
Yeah.
I assume that's a thing, right? Like that like PR says, keep it under wraps, mystery, mystery, mystery.
Yeah. But he talks about it more, actually, which surprised me, especially because it's not on the cover line. Like, he goes way more into, like, their relationship. It's surprising. And also, it's weird with her as well. When you're talking about magazine covers that, like, stick in your mind, there's obviously that Vanity Fair one, post-Brad, when she's in the white shirt and she makes the wasn't cool line. She is someone who maybe hasn't had a huge, as expected, movie career, but in terms of cultural penetration, like... She's
for sure
one of the main, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, when she her first post on Instagram is still like one of them. Just like everyone like lost their fucking minds. It's amazing. I love it. So here we are at the Sugar Ray cover with Mark McGrath, with his frosted tips, the most 90s. I mean, there's not much to say about Mark McGrath other than the fact that they had some fucking huge songs. Didn't he have like a bunch of a couple reality shows or something like that? Like where he was the host of some stuff or something like that. Maybe I'm making that up. I really don't know. I actually don't really have much to say about Mark McGrath, so we'll breeze past this pretty quickly. But I do want to just say the special report on the holy war on gays that's on the cover of Rolling Stone caught my eye. Did you read that, Tori?
I did read it.
Could you summarize that for us?
Depressing, actually. It's just like evangelicals, like the rise of evangelical Christians trying to push people in the closet.
We don't need to talk about that, but it's interesting that it got the cover is interesting. Now we are on to Jimi Hendrix. Guitar gods, the legends of guitar playing, finally speak. The list of the legends that speak in this issue are Keith Richards, Eric Clapton, The Edge, Tom Morello, Joni Mitchell, Peter Buck, Jeff Buck, Wyclef Jean, Eddie Van Halen, Jenny Lang, Kurt Hammett, and John Fogerty. Oh, I'm sorry. And also Robbie Robertson, Brian Setzer, Buddy Guy, Steve Miller, and Beck. Because it continues on the other side of the cover, which I didn't see. I mean, this is to me kind of a classically Rolling Stone cover in the sense of it being like, isn't rock and roll the fucking best, guys? Like, that's basically what this magazine was for a very long time. I don't know. I mean, I get it. It's not really my bag, but I don't know what you guys thought of it.
I mean, yeah, it feels like, I guess, because in this year, obviously heading towards the new millennium. I mean, they probably do these like every year anyway, but it felt like there was a lot more of them because I guess they were like, it's the end of the century. So they're like, let's fill it with best ofs. Yes.
I mean, yeah, we will at some point on this podcast do a Y2K.
Oh, please do. Episode
because of just all of the paranoia that surrounded this moment, and how much of a shrug it ended up being is just truly spectacular. Here's my question to you guys about this cover. Why is he standing on a T-bone steak?
That's my question. There's like a hand sticking out of the steak.
Giving a peace sign.
Yeah.
It's all very strange. The other things on this cover are Real Life X-Files, the internet millionaire search for aliens.
This is wild. I read this.
Oh, I didn't read it.
Okay.
Can you tell us about it, Tori?
This is like a millionaire Silicon Valley guy who became a millionaire at 18, and he's 28 now, and he left everything behind because an alien came to him in his sleep, and now he's investing all his money in preparing the human race for its inevitable encounter with aliens.
By the way, they're here, guys. But like, the world's on fire, and Trump is president still, unfortunately, for 30 more days. So everyone's just like, aliens, schmaliens, who cares?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I love that guy. Someone should make a movie about him. I also love this headline of considering Al Gore. Yeah. I would fucking hope you're considering this man. He could have been the president. Anyway, and then something about Hugh Hefner, but who really cares about Hugh Hefner?
But also, it's like resurrected, and it's like he's not dead yet. I mean, he might that looks like he might look like it, but
correct. He is not dead yet. Now we have, you know, arguably one of the biggest people ever in music, and certainly in the 90s. On the cover is Kurt Cobain. Who I guess was called the artist of the decade on this cover. He passes away in April of what year?
1994.
Right. So he's been gone for a while at this point. And yet, you know, obviously we still feel his footprint today, let alone, you know, the 6 years after his death. But I always found him to be a very, obviously, arresting-looking person. He's a very attractive man, or was an attractive man. But you could always tell he just kind of hated to have his photos taken. Like, it just never felt like he ever really was, quote-unquote, letting us in. But this is, I believe, I don't know if this was, this is a cropped shot from a different photo shoot, if I'm not mistaken. Is it not? I remember a photo shoot of the three of them all wearing suits. And I'm wondering if this is just a cropped, zoomed in shot of that, but I could be wrong.
It looks familiar to me. And that they were like, we don't need the other guys.
There is that too.
Just him. He's just ours for the
time. I was going to say, the funny thing about my introduction to Rolling Stone magazine is probably in an episode of My So-Called Life, when Rayanne holds up the Kurt Cobain Has Died cover. And I think that was maybe my introduction to this magazine. So it's that weird kind of... Yeah, so that was like 94. That would be, 94 when he died. So that's my little link to finding out what this magazine was.
Do you... Obviously, Tori wasn't born yet. But Emma, do you remember where you were when you found out that he died? Did it leave an impression on you at the time?
Yeah, I guess I would have just seen it on the, like, my parents watched the 6 o'clock news, so I'd imagine it would have been on that. Weirdly enough, the River Phoenix death is the one that I remember as, like, my first celebrity death, if that makes sense. Or, like, a young person dying who was famous. That one, like, hit me, and then I was a fan of Nirvana. I was, like, 12 when it... No, I was 11 when it happened. But I, like, a dinner lady at school had, like, made me, like, a cassette version of Nevermind before, like, he died. Because I was like, I really want to listen to this album.
I have a question for for the North Americans. What's a dinner lady?
So, like, I guess, a lunch lady?
Oh, okay.
Like a cafeteria? Like
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But she made my parents sign like a thing to say it was okay, because I guess the content was explicit, or like it was very weird.
That's crazy. I remember, I was 14 when he died, and obviously it was a very big deal.
Yeah.
It felt seismic. But I also got to be completely honest. I was not the biggest Nirvana fan in the world. That's not to take anything away from his unfortunate death. But I just remember it really fucking people up. And yeah. It also felt like immediately there was this, who's going to fill the vacuum of Kurt Cobain? It was like musically everyone was like searching through, trying to figure out like, who's it going to be? Which is insane to think about. And I would argue that no one really did. I mean, grunge kind of just goes away post his death. And there's an argument to be made for whether or not grunge was a movement that could have lasted much longer past, you know, his death anyway. It felt like it was already getting commodified and corporatized and sort of, so it was a movement that ultimately couldn't survive. That's not to say that Kurt Cobain couldn't have had a career like Eddie Vedder or turned Nirvana into some sort of, I mean, there's any number of musical lanes he could have gone down. Obviously, he was obviously a brilliant man. But yeah, so he's on the cover of this. Again, we've got a sort of a potpourri of other weird shit on here. It's the Essential Recordings of the 90s issue. Terror and Comedy, MTV's Tom Green. But I don't know about the terror part, but anyway. Orgy, Neil Young, Tori Amos, Jennifer Lopez, Ben Folds 5, everyone's favorite 5. It's such a strange 5 things. And then the government's marijuana report, again, still banging the pot drum. And then plus Hunter S. Thompson. So there's that. So it's something. So here we are. We are at arguably the biggest cover we'll probably cover, quote unquote, of this batch. The infamous Britney Spears cover. So Baby One More Time, the song, comes out in November of 98. The album drops in January of 99. And it's just like, I mean, it's hard to, for people who weren't listening to music or weren't sort of cognizant of these things back in 99. I mean, this thing was like a fucking virus. Like, it literally just took over. The song, the persona, the video. I mean, it was so pervasive that it was impossible to get away from. And this cover is really sort of in that maelstrom of Britney fever, you know, which ultimately leads to a million other pop artists, which some of which we'll touch on in this episode. The cover, if you haven't seen it, is Britney Spears laying on pink satin sheets, it looks like, holding a telephone, because all teenagers are on the phone.
With a cord.
With a cord, indeed, with a cord. A Teletubby. The name of the Teletubby is escaping me. I'm not sure which one it was.
Tinky Winky?
Do you guys know which one it was?
Tinky Winky.
I like, just went through like the song in my head. I was like, Tinky Winky, la la. Oh.
That was fantastic. And she's wearing a black bra. And a pair of underwear, I guess, or very short shorts, depending on how you think about this, that are polka dotted with some sort of a little tiny black bow. Yeah, she's got a shirt that has been, it looks like it's just been torn open. I mean, it is a very sexual cover that is taking this Lolita thing of hers of like, oh, who, me? Thing. What do you guys think of this cover?
I mean, it's it is literally like the defining for like the era that I know Rolling Stone. This is, other than that X-Files cover, I guess, and the Kurt Cobain one, this would have been like meeting like, oh yeah, Rolling Stone, I know what that is.
Sure.
Like, well, because I realized, like, I always bought Enemy when I was younger. I mean, I don't know if Rolling Stone was available where I lived. It might have been like an import, like it's available now and I've bought it. But yeah, at the time I didn't really consider it something that I would be able to find. But yeah, this cover is, it's that juxtaposition of, yeah, the Lita thing. So,
yeah, I mean, so I guess my question to you, Tori, being slightly younger than we are, but only a little bit, I'm kidding, is it feels like this is the beginning of something, which is sort of how far can we go with teens on our covers, essentially, and speaks to sort of this audacity of youth, it feels like it's this push and pull, which I'm having a tough time articulating. But there's this, first of all, there's the over-sexualized element of just men who like seeing younger women dressed scantily. So there's that, which apparently will never get old. Apparently that's just, I don't know. And then you have sort of teens that are looking to shock, right? Like the sort of looking for attention, forgive that expression, but that kind of mixed into all of this and the media just weaponizing the fuck out of both of those things.
Yeah.
So that's why I think this cover feels like such a lightning rod, because it feels like it's this moment where pop music obviously is all the rage, but it's also like, oh, we can also just go this far with this. Do you feel like this is all that audacious now, Tori?
No. No.
It's kind of tame now.
Yeah.
Like,
my knowledge of this cover, even at the time, like, well, I have a memory of seeing this cover. I don't know when, but it wasn't like scandalous to me. Just like anything, yeah. Britney did, I was like, this is incredible. Like, Britney, look at you go.
Well, sure. There is, I guess that's my other question, which is there, and I hate to even ask this question as a man, but is there some semblance of empowerment in this image?
I mean, potentially, I think it's important to recognize as well that the photographer, David LaChapelle, is a gay man. And so it doesn't have that same, if it was Terry Richardson, this would be the worst fucking thing I'd ever seen. But you know what I mean? Like, it takes away the kind
of... Did he do the Gossip Girl one though? Isn't that Terry Richardson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, is the difference, like, it's still...
Even the gay one too.
Yeah. There's this in the book that I have. God, I'm such a nerd. There's a quote from David LaChapelle that says, "I said to Britney, you don't want to be buttoned up like Debbie Gibson. Let's push it further and do this whole Alita thing." She got it. She knew it would get people talking and excited. So it was very contrived.
That, I mean, Dave LaChapelle, who has had an enormous career, and it's interesting that you say that, because you can tell. By the way, the contrasty colors, the way that he sort of, which is a very, you know, there's a lot of very high contrast, poppy sort of colors in a lot of his photography. So you definitely sense that, especially in the periphery of the satin. But yeah, it does feel, the look in her eyes definitely has an element of sort of, obviously bedroom eyes, but mixed into it does feel a little bit like she knows what she's doing.
Yeah. I think what's more disturbing is the intro to the piece, which was written by a man.
Yeah.
Which can I read this? Okay.
Can you please.
Okay. Britney Spears extends a honey thigh across the length of a sofa, keeping one foot on the floor as she does so. Her blonde street hair is piled high, exposing two little diamond earrings on each earlobe. Her face is fully made up down to the carefully applied lip liner. The baby fat logo of Spears' pink t-shirt is distended by her ample chest, and her silky white shorts with dark blue piping cling snugly to her hips. She cocks her head and smiles receptively.
Okay, that's fucked up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The words are worse than the images, like much worse.
Yeah.
Ample chest.
Not okay.
No.
It's, yeah, that's really interesting. I imagine that the article certainly sounds far more misogynistic than the cover would convey necessarily. Yeah. I don't know, guys. Britney Spears is, I mean, she's a complicated figure in an interesting way. You know, I do feel that she's hasn't really been allowed to live her life basically since the moment that she became famous. It's a lot, and it's sort of there's so much to unpack with her, and it does feel like this issue, and by that I mean the issue of Rolling Stone, does really kind of start it all off. It does feel like it starts the fire a little bit, but.
And I don't know if Tori wants to share who gets a mention in the piece.
Carrie Russell.
I'm assuming because they were both in Mickey Mouse Club together, correct?
She's watching Felicity during this interview. But she does say that it's too neurotic for her.
But then she also...
That's fair, I guess.
She does.
That might be why I love it.
Yeah, she calls Carrie Russell breathtaking, though.
Yes.
I mean, she is.
Yeah.
She says, isn't she breathtaking? So cute. I was like, so true, Britney.
If you didn't love Britney before, how can you love her now? Yeah, it's that's interesting. She calls it too neurotic. That's interesting.
Right.
Because it's like that's just a word choice that I wouldn't necessarily have associated with Britney Spears.
It's not a direct quote. It's just
not a direct quote.
It's not a direct quote. So I think he's maybe inferred it. Potentially, but then she does like to read. Britney, that always had a book with her. There was always this thing about there's a really good episode of Mystery Show.
I was just gonna say, it's so good.
Which, yeah, RIP that amazing show. Britney likes to read.
I would say, other than that intro, the article is like she just seems so sweet, and it makes me so sad. So sad.
Yeah, it's. The other thing that I think about in terms of like the path not taken, or like what the careers would have been like if her and Justin had stayed together, like I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing.
I think me and both Tori and Tori are like, no.
I'm not suggesting that. Listen, I don't. I'm not going to sit here and like ride for Justin Timberlake necessarily. but I do think that it was like they were the king and queen of pop in that moment.
Yeah.
And who could forget them in head to toe denim?
Literally.
I don't know what red carpet it was, but it was something to remember.
I think it was an MTV awards of some kind.
It was bonkers.
Yep.
It did make me laugh.
It was like someone just draped them in denim and said, go. It's crazy. I just feel like, what's his face? What's her boy? Her husband, or the father of her children?
Kevin Federline.
This was not the right guy.
Something that made me laugh is they mentioned like the Justin Timberlake rumors, but they also mentioned Lance Bass. So like the rumors of you, Lance Bass.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So also on this cover, we have Bill Maher still pissing people off back in 99. Norm MacDonald, Ready or Not for primetime. Turns out he was not.
I didn't even know he had
no offense to Norm MacDonald. Cher, obviously having a huge hit in Believe, where she sounded like a robot, but everybody loved it. And The Lost Tribes of the Amazon. I don't know what that is, but there you go. Okay. Moving on to another lightning rod of pop culture at the time is Eminem.
Yeah.
Looking like an asshole.
I skipped this one as well.
We don't need to talk about him too much, but he was a big deal, obviously.
Sure.
I would argue, you know, when he first came onto the scene, I didn't really get it because it all felt like a bit. It felt like a sketch. The whole Slim Shady thing to me, I was just like, I don't really get this. Mm-hmm. But I will say that when the Marshall Mathers EP comes out, and Stan, and it just, it did feel like he was digging a little deeper, getting a little darker. That made him a little bit more interesting to me. But again, like, I'm not the biggest Eminem fan, and this cover makes me want to punch him in the face.
The cover and the article, I was like, I hate this.
The article is titled "Lowdown and Dirty White Boy Rap: Eminem's Twisted Life Story." Also on this cover, we have the Red Hot Chili Peppers' "Red Hot Comeback," "Californication," a very big album in '99. Some Marilyn Manson and Hole, which is what's amazing is on the previous cover it says Hole and Manson going on tour. This cover says Manson and Hole tour DOA.
I also saw Marilyn Manson in '99. At Big Day Out, it was like a one-day festival. I didn't go for Marilyn Manson. I vaguely remember him showing his butthole. Because,
holy shit!
Yeah, at 16, that's a thing.
That's something that stays with you.
Yeah, so that was so the fact that I saw Hole and Marilyn Manson just separately. So
that's crazy. Yeah. Yeah, I don't even really have.
My only note on this one is in the article, Eminem keeps talking about his life, like what a hard life he's had, and like he said my mom was doing drugs and all this stuff, and then they keep having like his mom commenting and like that's not true. Like, that didn't happen. She's like, I've never done drugs in my life.
That's interesting. That makes you wonder whether or not like so much of Eminem is a persona and that it's all kind of a built-up thing. But I want to talk about the next two at the same time because they were released, I believe, in the same week. This was a New Teen Spirit, which, God, like how many weeks earlier you have Kurt Cobain and now this is the New Teen Spirit. It's a special issue, two different covers. The first one has the Backstreet Boys on it. It's your classic Backstreet Boys pose of just the five of them just being like pretty innocuous, just sort of nice enough guys, not really, you know, particularly interesting. And on this cover also has the Texas Heroin Massacre, one town, 18 dead.
Dark, very dark.
Dark as fuck to have on here. And then they refer to the Jennifer Love Hewitt cover, which is the other cover where she is referred to as the Love Goddess. I don't really know how to feel about that. But
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, I guess I want to just start by saying Backstreet Boys or NSYNC. If you had to choose, gun to your head, which are you choosing?
NSYNC.
I mean,
literally because of Britney. I'm not even kidding. Like, that's why I loved NSYNC.
Emma refuses to answer the question. She's taking the fifth.
I think they're both fine. I would dance to their songs when I was out. I would probably not listen to it in my house. Like, no, sure. But they were great at what they did. Yes. But yeah, boy bands weren't really my thing.
My roommate was how old? She was 10 in 1999. So she was very much into the pop scene. And I remember years ago, I posed this question to her and said, "NSYNC or Backstreet Boys?" And she was like, I can't possibly choose. They're both doing drastically different things. And I was like,
that's true. Okay. That's so true.
Can I throw up a curveball? So, you know. I would go S Club 7 if I had to pick.
Love that. Love their show.
That's sure, sure.
Yeah, no, of course. Great show. They were great. Yeah, that's good. That's a good call. Jennifer Love Hewitt, just to talk about her for a quick second here, because she did have a big moment. I mean, Party of Five, she was on that. And then I Know What You Did Last Summer, Can't Hardly Wait. I mean, she was every teenage guy's dream sort of girl next door.
That's what this article like actually says. Her success results from her ability to strike a balance between being the woman of our dreams and the girl next door.
They also call her
America's most adorable cottage industry.
Right.
I don't know what that means.
It was because she was doing everything allegedly, like singing, producing, but it seems like an odd. Yeah. I don't remember any of that.
Yeah. I do remember she sang too. This is, you know, it's funny. This is sort of a prime example of like, it felt like back in the 90s was sort of the beginning of the, I want to be like a triple or quadruple threat. Like I want to be an actor. I want to be a singer. I want to be a dancer. I want to like, and J-Lo is also coming out of this too. Like her first album comes out in 99. So it's certainly like the beginning of that. So it's interesting. And I do think that, you know, it's so funny how like the Academy, and I would say sort of like Hollywood by and large, doesn't take too well to musicians that decide they want to be actors. It's like stay in your fucking lane, which I think is interesting. Yeah. But the music industry is like, sure, come on in. The water's warm. Like, whatever. If you want to sing, we'll let you sing. I just think it's kind of amazing.
Also, this image like of her in the white and she's in this like, you know, so under sheets. Yeah, it's like the opposite of the Britney one in a way, which is, she's like 20 years old in this picture. So she's actually older, but she looks younger.
Yeah, they're really playing up her sort of this innocence thing. It's interesting.
She had a spin-off as well, right, that year that didn't do anything. Because I think that's in the TV issue.
They really thought that was gonna happen. People loved her in Party of Five. It's not shocking that they tried to do a spin-off of it, sure. But yeah.
That show was just too depressing. Like I watched it and I remember just being like, this is like the one, like so depressing.
It leans into it so hard too.
Yeah.
Like it's so precious. There's so many pregnant pauses. It's all just very, it's too much. It's very wrought.
Never seen it.
I think you would love it, Tori.
It sounds like something.
I don't say that in a derogatory way. Like it's very like, I'm sure it's streaming somewhere. Part of the problem, and I'm sure Emma, you can attest to this. The problem with 90s shows that are streaming is the fucking music isn't with it.
Yeah.
So it's all bad because they're just like terrible. Killed it with this shitty, like, listen, Felicity, obviously I kept my head down and I keep watching it because I love it. But like just not having Paula Cole in the credit sequence of Dawson's Creek is a crime.
Oh, see, okay. I have a thing here. So when this show first aired in the UK, season one, we had that other theme song. So
really?
So for the first season, we had the other theme song. So I love it. I love that other theme song. I'm not kidding.
Like I know. Sure you're telling the truth.
So people got really mad about the theme song replacement, and I'm like, it's great. Like this, yeah. I don't know why we had that other version, but I'm team that other version.
Fair enough. So now we have we got Mike Myers, Austin Powers. He's back, baby. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What are your thoughts on Austin Powers, guys? Fans, not fans?
No.
I liked it at the time. I haven't revisited it. So
I'm curious because being British, Emma, this is far more of a sort of he's mocking or it's more of a parody of your spy content than it is North American spy content, right? So like people that it's, I guess what I'm saying is, I think it's funny that this was a hit in the United States because like he's making fun of like Peter Sellers and a whole bunch. It's like stuff that you're just like, I'd just be surprised. I just was surprised that it was a big hit.
It's very niche. And yeah, the fact
it was huge,
wasn't it?
It's very niche.
Beyoncé did a song.
Well, the second one, which we covered in a previous episode. Beyoncé did a song for the third one. Madonna did a song for the second one. Beautiful Stranger, I believe, was the name of it. And he's in the music video with her. And yeah, it was a big, big hit. This thing was enormous and it cost like nothing and whatever. People loved it. Also on this cover, we got Nas, Ricky Martin, Insane Clown Posse, three people never spoken of in the same sentence ever. And then Life and Death at the Columbine High School. Dark. Because around this time, you had the Columbine shooting. Very strange. Very strange cover. But, you know, whatever. It's Austin Powers. People loved it.
It's interesting from this point as well, the Columbine stuff, is that it literally, like, weaves its way. And I understand why it weaves its way through, because there was the pop culture aspect and who they were blaming. Sure. But it's interesting to see how seismic it was. And it should be seismic that something like that happens. And it kind of is awful that we're so desensitized to it now that if that happened, we'd be like, okay, that's another one.
It's like, if it happens now, you know, they pull some episodes of television and postpone them, or they postpone the release of a movie or something. And then we all move on. It's fucked. It's insane. It was obviously a very big deal. And it's sort of in the pop culture universe, and we'll touch on it because it comes up a little bit on the next cover as well, of people that are being blamed. Is pop culture to blame, or video games to blame? Is, you know, Marilyn Manson to blame? Is The Matrix to blame? Like, who did this? It can't possibly be anyone else's fault but pop culture.
Right.
The next cover is an infamous figure, a polarizing figure who still to this day drives people crazy. Jar Jar Binks finally getting his moment in the spotlight on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine.
The headline is great, though. Jar Jar Superstar is, like, honestly iconic.
Jar Jar Superstar is iconic in the fact that it never happened.
Right?
Yeah. I remember this cover. I remember the build-up, obviously, to episode one was insane. I mean, truly unlike anything that had ever happened before, for obvious reasons. This cover is a allusion to another Rolling Stone cover 18 some odd years previous, which was E.T. being on the cover of Rolling Stone. He's holding an issue of Variety, and it says "A Star Is Born." And it's literally like I posted this on Twitter. If anyone is interested in seeing it, you can see the covers next to each other. It's just obvious that they're like Jar Jar is the new E.T. spoiler: he was not. No one liked Jar Jar. And unfortunately, the man who portrayed Jar Jar went through a whole host of unfortunate depression because of that. You asked why, Tori. And it's a good question. It's a good question because, like, yes, please.
It's kind of sad because I saw this cover and I said, why? And then I read the article and it's about the guy who plays Jar Jar. And I was like, why couldn't you just put him on the cover?
Right.
Why it's so sad because it's such a sweet article about how excited this guy is and to know what happens in the future.
It's really sad. I mean, to your point, I think that all things being equal, if this had been a suit, right? Like rather than like a CG creation, I'm sure he would have been like holding the fucking headpiece or something like that or something to that. Like, I think they were kind of really fully baked into this horrendous CG creation that they had created. It's also interesting. You say why, and I think to myself, considering all the Star Wars covers we've had before this and the ones that would come after this, generally speaking, it's a cast shot. It's usually like the full cast, all there, Star Wars. This is like all in on Jar Jar, and it's unfortunate.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
In the article, they say Jar Jar was a gay pioneer. Was this a thing?
I don't remember that.
Wait, I'm sorry, Tori. You broke up a little bit there. Could you repeat that for me?
Okay. So they say that the movie sparked talk about Jar Jar being a gay pioneer in the Star Wars galaxy.
Yeah, okay. So that's I thought that's what you said, but I just wanted to be 100% sure before I said I've never heard anything like that in my life. And I don't quite know why. I mean he's an outsider in his alien race, I guess. I don't know. I find you got to really want it. You got to really twist yourself into pretzels to say that Jar Jar is a gay icon.
Were they trying to make him happen? And they were like, I know, this is how we can do it.
By the way, that would have been a great way to get, that's,
I was going to say, they wanted what the Babadook has. Like,
who doesn't, right? Also on this cover, you got Tom Waits, Chili Peppers, Jerry Halliwell, Kosovo, Faces of Fear, and Columbine, Whose Fault Is It? A Marilyn Manson article that he wrote, defending essentially freedom of speech and how that's not the reason that people shoot their friends at schools. So now we're at my favorite cover of 1999. First of all, I love Eyes Wide Shut. It is one of my favorite films of 99. This is also, I would argue, Nicole Kidman looking perhaps her most stunning. Like, she's really, this is a beautiful cover. I had this issue. I was interested, obviously, in the article about Eyes Wide Shut. But I also was just like, I don't know. There's something about this cover that feels very sort of, not Nicole Kidman up until this point, I guess, is sort of what I'm getting at. This feels very much like Eyes Wide Shut, for all intents and purposes, felt like her turning a page as an actor. And I would argue, I don't know that she was ever respected as an actor as much up until this point. And a lot of that had to do with her making shitty movies with her husband, like Days of Thunder and Far and Away. Neither of which did her any favors. But this movie really kind of takes her to the next level. Her performance, her scene in the bedroom before is just the best. What are your thoughts on this cover? And then did you guys read the article?
This is just like looking through the covers. This is like objectively like the best cover of 99, just like the most striking one that actually looks good. So there's that.
Yeah.
Emma?
I agree. It's very evocative and you are going to be like, oh, and the fact that there's no mention of Tom on the cover, which is nice. Like, yes. She doesn't get the... Because, and it's also interesting, I guess, because Jen's TV, and this feels like how TV and film, obviously in 99, were seen as these two very different things, whereas now they've kind of merged a little bit. So, like, Nicole is a superstar, like, movie star. She doesn't need her husband's name on there, whereas because Jen's TV, they're like, oh, we should probably mention Brad. Mm-hmm. That's how I read it.
I tend to agree. I also feel like... It felt like a little bit of a coming out party for Nicole Kidman in terms of like, it's time to take her seriously. She's in a Stanley Kubrick film and blah, blah, blah. I do think that this film successfully destroys her marriage and then sends her off into a much better trajectory of her career. The idea of... I'm spending 18 months with Stanley Kubrick just destroying your marriage, like doing everything in his power to make you resent each other and also not sexually attracted to each other in case you were. I'll make sure you're not by the end of this production. It shouldn't surprise anybody. But
I was going to say,
it's really something.
This one also has the best lead. Like, the opening sentence is, Nicole Kidman is weeping. Like,
yes. That is death.
That is attention grabbing. Like, because he's just died. So, like, I guess I'll
I really, now I'm really wishing that I actually read this article. I need to find this article and read it.
Me too. There's a lot of Tom.
I did read it in 99, but sorry, what was that term?
There's a lot of Tom in this article, I would say.
Oh, well, I bet. Because there's about
the movie, but, and then yeah, there's a Tom quote where he said, we're going to sit back together at 80 years old and say, remember last century when he made that movie?
By the way, that might still happen. They just won't be married when they do it.
And then, like, at the end, Nicole, like, has the interviewer, like, put money on her and Tom staying together.
Stop it.
Yeah. They divorced two years later.
That is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, this is also, so Nicole Kidman, I mean, I'm a very big fan of Nicole Kidman. I really do love her. And I think her career has been fascinating. I think that To Die For was sort of the film that everyone thought was going to be the one, which is a couple years earlier, which is a tremendous pitch black comedy, which shows that she can do comedy really well. It's just a very specific brand of comedy. She's not great at broad comedy. And when they put her in broad comedies, it doesn't work. Bewitched comes to mind. But this is sort of a moment for her. I still can't believe she wasn't nominated for an Academy Award for Eyes Wide Shut. I'm actually surprised that Eyes Wide Shut didn't get more Academy Awards by and large. It's shocking to me how few it got. If I'm being honest, I'm not sure it got any. But the Tom and Nicole thing, like, this is the reason that I think this movie destroyed their career, their marriage is that everyone thought this was going to be like a really hot, sexy movie between these two people, which, let's be real, have no sexual chemistry. Like, yeah. they just don't.
But he doesn't really with anyone. He's like one of these figures who he doesn't really have that much. Like, I don't need to ever see a Tom Cruise sex scene. Like, no offense to the guy. Like,
I would argue the only movie he has really good chemistry is Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
Like, they do have great chemistry. And when, like, they're kissing and making out and whatever, I'm like, this works. But that's basically it. Like, I agree with you. I don't see him as a charismatic lead. But then on top of all of that, they're in a film by the least sexiest filmmaker. Like, Stanley Kubrick's not a guy that I'm just like, oh, he's going to make a cold, cerebral, fucked up, weird sex movie. It's fantastic.
That's what they mentioned on the article too. Like, Nicole's like, people think this is going to be like a sexy movie. Like, they're going to be surprised when they see it.
And let me tell you, America was surprised when they saw it.
It's funny how long it takes Scientology to get mentioned. Like, I assume, because I was reading it, I was like, this is not getting mentioned. They must have, like, had a thing. And it gets right at the end. And Nicole, like, she asks, did you have to embrace Scientology in order to marry Tom? No way. I would never have married him if that was it. Which seems like a lie. Like, yeah. She just says that she likes parts of Scientology and that she's like, I like a bit of Judaism and a bit of Catholicism. Yeah. I'm a melting pot.
She's like, I went to church last week.
I gotta say, the Scientological elements of their marriage make very little sense to me. I also, their adopted children, of which we never see or hear from or know anything about these children. It really does feel like Nicole Kidman was some sort of an anomaly in the Tom Cruise Scientology sphere, because everyone since, for all intents and purposes, either like your Penelope Cruz, which I guess basically was like, yeah, no, I'm not getting into that Scientology shit, and then that just went away, and then obviously Katie Holmes, which went all in on it, for good or bad, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, it's very interesting. It's just interesting. It's a great cover. It's a great issue. Other things on this cover, we've got Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor talking about their new album, The Fragile, which would have the dubious achievement of being the steepest drop in the history of Billboard's from its first week to its second week. Mm-hmm. People did not like The Fragile, but we will be doing an episode on it soon, and I'm excited to talk about it. Missy Elliott, Santana, Limp Bizkit, and South Park Fights Back.
This is the beginning of the Limp Bizkit, like... Yep. Five mentions in a row after this. It's insane.
People love Nookie. What can I tell you? They really do. Next up, we've got Ricky Martin. Ricky Gets Deep, talking sex, love, marriage, and yoga. I don't know what to say about this, guys. Ricky Martin was a moment. And I would say sort of the Latin music, however you want to kind of describe it, Latin pop that sort of, and he was certainly at the tip of the spear on it. Living La Vida Loca, guys. You couldn't get away from it.
It was pretty bad.
Ricky Martin fan as well.
Were you?
There's a video of me on Christmas receiving a Ricky Martin cassette tape. I think it's from 99 too. And I lose my mind.
You need to post that video.
I will. Like, I'm like, oh my God, it's Ricky Martin. I like start singing. It's
great. I bet he would love that. Ricky Martin, by the way, hasn't aged a day since 1999 somehow. That guy is just,
It's interesting seeing as well, like having the whole sexuality thing. And obviously there was like this constant people were asking him or at least alluding to the fact that he might be gay. Yep. And I read this profile and then I read when he came out and how it was just like really tough for him. And I think it, like, obviously things are better now in terms of like how people approach the LGBTQ community. But it just made me sad reading about him, like, and having to put on this front, and it's just bullshit basically.
Yeah. It's obviously it's unfortunate. He should be able to live the life he wants to live. That should go without saying. And the idea that, that might take him out of certain demographics or hurt record sales in some form or another is ultimately, as we can tell now, pretty short-sighted. But we're also talking about a time where, like, you know, a few years from now, I guess they're not the Dixie Chicks anymore, but the Chicks would have their old blow up with George W. Bush. And, you know, I guess it just goes to show that, you know, some music speaks to a certain demographic, and those demographics, basically religious zealots, those people tend to be a prickly. Who knew?
Yeah.
But it's a nice cover, though. You know, it's what it is. Also on the cover, Limp Bizkit, Smash Mouth, Celebrity Deathmatch. I don't know what that is.
Do you not remember the claymation thing on MTV?
No. Oh, on MTV.
They would like, it was like claymation fighting each other.
I'm from Toronto, guys, so I didn't have MTV. So.
It was insane.
Yeah, it sounds crazy. And then a special report on George W. Bush, the GOP's empty suit.
I read this.
Kind of making a strong point. Next we have Angelina Jolie on the cover of the Hot List of 1999. I mean, Angelina Jolie. So, okay. I like Angelina Jolie. I actually think she's quite good in Girl Interrupted. She should not have won an Academy Award for the performance, in my humble opinion. She was up against, for those that don't know, and I know I beat this drum a lot, but she was up against Samantha Morton in Sweet and Lowdown. Catherine Keener in Being John Malkovich. Why am I drawing a blank on her name? She was Hereditary.
Toni Collette.
Toni Collette in The Sixth Sense, and I'm drawing a blank on what the fifth one was, and it's bothering me. Long story short, I don't think Angelina Jolie should have won. I think Catherine Keener should have won, but it really sends her on sort of a massive trajectory. I mean, this is someone who becomes essentially a movie star in over the course of a year. I mean, it's pretty insane. She's also like a ridiculously sexy individual. Like, there's just she weaponizes it and any sort of chance that she gets. What are your thoughts on this cover?
I think it's interesting that we get Brad, Jen, and Angelina on this year. I think that's kind of fun. Always bring it back.
That is amazing entry.
It's the classic. It's another kind of bad shot. So her gaze, if you compare hers to Britney's, hers is obviously way more overt. And it's good because she's older, so... The cover line, though, devil...
Yeah, I mean, Angelina Jolie looks like she's going to devour you.
Yeah, devil doll is the headline, and some of the stuff in the profile is dubious as fuck. I'm not even... Honestly, there's the phrase embryonic bombshell talking about her playing, like, kissing games with boys in the playground.
Yeah.
That's how the reporter refers to her.
Embryonic bombshell. Great album, though.
Right?
What the fuck does that mean?
I don't know.
She is definitely, I mean, listen, she's looking at the camera like she's about to literally unhinge her jaw and just like a praying mantis. Also on this cover, Limp Bizkit, third issue in a row, Korn and the rock porn connection. Don't know what the fuck that means. My first time, True Tales from American Pie.
This is really, that's a fucked up piece. I don't know if you read that story. Oh my God.
Just pressuring these people to reveal when they lost their virginity.
So it was the cast, the cast of American Pie making them explain when they lost their virginity.
That is not okay. No. What the fuck were they thinking?
So weird.
I mean, I guess the thought was like the movie's about losing your virginity, so you know you gotta fess up. But like that's inappropriate.
And they're really judgy because the guys are all quite like they don't want to talk about it. But the girls, and the girls are a little bit more. So they're like, oh, it's strange that women want to talk about sex, but the guys don't.
Yeah,
it's fucked.
I mean, these are a bunch of like emo like. These actors are not guys that are going to want to talk about their, but that's also on this cover. You got Carlos Santana, Lit, a band I completely forgot existed, and Blink 182. Next up, we have this is just a live issue about like Woodstock 99, so there's really no reason to talk about that. But now we can talk about a cover that shouldn't exist, that should be burned, and it's shocking to me that this exists. This is the stuff of nightmares. David Spade got a cover of Rolling Stone magazine. And not just any cover, the hot and horny cover. It's not okay.
No.
Sexy moms, torrid teens, freaks, geeks, and aliens, fall TV forecast. I did you read this? You read this this article, Tori? Okay, cool. Because I want to hear all about it.
I mean...
But before we get to that, let's talk about what we're looking at here, which is I guess I could only describe this as a Midsummer Night's Dream situation of some sort. Two women, models of which I've never seen before or since, are newts in some sort of a Garden of Eden. And David Spade has hoof legs. Oof. He's got the legs of a horse.
It's pure nightmare fuel.
it's real nightmare fuel. And he just looks, you know, like he's naughty. It's fucked. It's fucked on so many levels. I don't like it. I want it to stop. Can we talk about the fall TV part of it?
It's so weird. Like the connections they make is just like, there's a hot mom in this show. There's a hot mom in this show.
There's hot teens. There's a lot of hot teens. Manchester Prep. So the Cruel Intentions spinoff, which obviously then got made into Cruel Intentions 2.
Which they call the anti-Felicity. They say Manchester Prep is the anti.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's why no one watched it.
It's, you know, it's funny as we talk about all of this kind of like sexually charged, ginned up kind of like ridiculous. It does make me think about like, around this time, you've got Maxim magazine. You've got a lot of these like these kind of like sexed up magazines for boys that, I guess let's be honest, can't buy Playboy and Penthouse, but they could sure buy a Maxim magazine at the convenience store. It feels a little bit like they're feeding that demo. But I mean,
that's also an excellent phrase that made me laugh a lot. Instead of beefcake, veal cake, which is the worst thing I've ever heard. So talking about like the young hot guys, they're veal cake. It's so fucked up.
They also talk about the West Wing, and they describe Rob Lowe's character as a hornier, prettier Stephanopoulos stand-in.
I mean, by the way, that's not an unfair
not wrong, categorization
but...
of the rule.
But veal cake to me is, first of all, to quote Sex and the City, it's a morally questionable meat. And then to somehow merge it with sex makes it even more upsetting.
Yeah.
The next issue that we have is The Greatest Concerts of the 90s. It's a special issue. Eddie Vedder's on the cover in a mosh pit, which became sort of the parlance of our time in the 90s of concerts. I'm going to list the other bands that are on the cover here because it really is a time capsule. You got Pearl Jam, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Smashing Pumpkins, Beck, Nirvana, Metallica, Fish, U2, Madonna, Rolling Stones, Lollapalooza, Puff Daddy, Sonic Youth, Bob Dylan, Beastie Boys, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and the Chemical Brothers. You also have two really politically charged headlines of I Hate the Suburbs by PJ O'Rourke and Al Gore's Lousy Summer, which is fantastic and accurate, as we can all attest. So now we have one of the sort of one of the biggest musicians of the 90s and arguably is still incredibly, you know, relevant and has sort of merged into different musical terrain. Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, he's coming. This is interesting. I don't know if you guys have watched Song Exploder on Netflix.
I watched it yesterday because I never really listened to Nine Inch Nails. So
I cherry pick. There are songs of Nine Inch Nails, and I would argue there are albums of theirs that I do really like. But yeah, it's you know, you got to be in a mood. But they did an episode on Hurt on Song Exploder where he breaks down the making of this song. And what's interesting about it is where we're catching this artist at this moment is Downward Spiral has come out a few years previously. It's one of the biggest albums ever, ultimately. And he has no idea how to follow it up. It sinks him into a pretty terrible depression. And The Fragile is what comes out of that, a double album of just a very tortured soul. It's tough. I mean, I feel for the guy. It's just interesting how Nine Inch Nails is the beginning of something, which we're still feeling today to a certain degree, which is sort of this like emo goth prog rock sort of with like electronic influences. Like what I think is so impressive about Nine Inch Nails and why they're still relevant and why, quite frankly, they're still making music is they don't fit into a box. I think that, you know, Marilyn Manson was kind of just doing David Bowie through the prism of like, you know, angsty kind of emo, you know, goth, what have you. Trent Reznor felt like he just kind of didn't really want to be put in a box, which I appreciate. That being said, this cover of Trent sitting in a corner or like a little nook or of a garden or a hole, essentially, wearing a black tank top and black pants and just looking like, I don't know, like he just doesn't want to be there. What do you guys think of this cover?
I mean, maybe he was promoting Blair Witch. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting.
There is a bit of Blair Witch there. Yeah,
it was October, you know?
It was October.
But other than that, it's not really enticing.
Yeah, he just doesn't look great. He just doesn't look like he's happy to be there. But there are a lot of other people on this cover that I do find really interesting. You've got a fall album preview. You've got Beck's Midnight Vultures, which is about to come out, which is one of my favorite albums of 99. Fiona Apple's When the Pawn, which is arguably my favorite album of 99. Rage Against the Machine has their, Battle for Los Angeles, which is about to come out. And Jay-Z, I'm not unfortunately sure which Jay-Z album it was about to come out. But it's an interesting time in music. At least the tail end of 99 felt like there were a couple really interesting albums that came out. This is the College 99 issue, Sorority Girl Secrets, Cheating Goes Digital, The Rise and Fall of a Campus Nazi.
Very on
topic. Three headlines.
Yeah.
Did you read any of those, Tori?
I read them all. Well, the neo-Nazi
one. Can you tell us about them?
The neo-Nazi one is like a profile of a neo-Nazi, which I was like, I don't want to read this. So I guess I kind of just skimmed that one.
Yeah.
And then the sorority one was weird. It was just about like sorority girls like doing drugs and drinking. And then the cheating one was just that like the internet, you can find free term papers on the internet. Watch out.
Oh, that kind of cheating.
Oh, that cheating. Yeah,
not like, that's what I thought too, but
oh,
no.
Infidelity?
Oh.
No, no.
That's amazing.
Can I ask a question about the other cover line? Who the fuck is Bill Bradley?
I don't know.
Was he the other Democratic nominee?
Okay.
Oh.
Against Gore, yeah. I think that's who it is.
That's fantastic. Okay. Our next cover is a big one, guys. Yes. It's Brad.
Yes.
It's Brad. He's just okay. So he's wearing a dress, right? It's a dress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So okay, this feels like this is something I'm very interested to talk to both of you guys about. Tyler Durden as a style icon.
Sure.
Because so Fight Club comes out in October. This is right around the time that the Fight Club comes out. And pretty much tanks. it does fine, but it was very expensive. No one really knew what to make of it at the time. Certainly Fox had no idea how to market the movie. The posters were terrible. They just really didn't know what to do with this film. Hindsight being what it is, if this film came out today, it'd make like $700 million worldwide or something like that. But part of the marketing of this film was Brad as Tyler Durden, for lack of a better way of putting it, and this sort of androgyny mixed with aliens, mixed with like just a whole bunch of shit. It's essentially it's a little bit of the transition of his character within the film Fight Club when he gets full space monkey by the end of the film. But this is all a long way of saying that this felt very groundbreaking at the time. It felt like it was really sort of trying to puncture the notions of masculinity and what it meant to be a movie star. And why are you putting me on a pedestal? Like, it felt like this was a real moment where Brad Pitt was trying to deconstruct his persona and what people thought of him. And it all kind of goes over like a lead balloon. But what did you guys think of it?
Well, I think in terms of the costume design, particularly, like, it's Michael Kaplan who did Blade Runner. He did the recent Star Wars movie. So he always has this slight element of, like, fantasy in it. And he's very good at outerwear, particularly, is, like, I would say, the really notable thing. And obviously there's this fur coat is one of the standout pieces. But then he's, like, mixed it with this, like, graphic print tank that's kind of got the porn images on it. And so it's meant to look kind of 70s thrift, and like I think the phrase he used that he wanted it to look like something that no one else would want to like own. And then because Brad Pitt wore it, everyone wanted to own it. But because most people aren't Brad Pitt, it's not going to look like that on them, which is a sad truth that most of us have to like realize. It's we can't That's wear amazing. Red leather.
Yeah, it's so funny because it does feel like there were definitely I vividly remember people trying to rock a Tyler Durden look, or at least bits and pieces of a Tyler Durden look in my high school, and then ultimately, I guess it's more university, but still. And to your point, it doesn't work as a commentary on an average normal person. Yeah. On Brad Pitt, it's saying something.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Tyler Durden, Tori? Do you, yeah.
I mean, I didn't see Fight Club until, like, in the last maybe 5 years I watched it for the first time. So I guess it didn't have the same effect on me because it didn't seem that weird watching it now. But your comment about red leather made me realize that I did own red pleather pants and a red pleather jacket in the early 2000s. So I was like, is this a result of
I think so. So I rewatched, I did this Bridget Jones' His Diary thing for another piece I was doing. And at the premiere, though, so Paris and Nikki Hilson were there, and I swear Nikki is wearing red leather jacket, this graphic print top, and I'm like, she's fucking dressed as Tyler Durden. It's so weird. But like a sexy Nikki Hilton version.
You know, I keep thinking about the alternate universe where Fight Club's a big hit, you know, and that it actually really sort of connects with an audience. It ultimately, I mean, this film was not a unmitigated failure by any means. Like, it did quite well on video. It you know, it ultimately did just fine. And it's obviously a real hallmark of 99. But it's so funny, Tori, that you watched it recently and you were sort of like, yeah, okay. Like, and which is completely fair. But thinking about it back in 99, it was shocking.
Yeah.
Like it really was.
Especially for Brad Pitt, because we were so used to him playing these kind of like very pretty, like there was always some kind of masculinity aspect to it, but he was like always just like the heartthrob. And this interview in particular is so fascinating in terms of how a celebrity profile is written, because it kind of like takes away the artifice, because the interviewer actually has a full-blown argument with him about a question that he asked at a different time. So like he was in Portugal with Brad, and then they have this meeting, like they have lunch, and Brad's taken issue with him like asking him about people perceiving him as stupid, because obviously at the time people probably maybe thought he was like a himbo.
Can I just say, this leads to one of my favorite things ever, which is apparently when Brad was sent the script by the Coen brothers for Burn After Reading, he said to them, I don't think I can act this stupid. And they said, you'll do fine. I love it so much.
It gets into the craft and the whole like, and there's this whole thing about him not wanting to like highlight the tooth thing that he did, and yeah. Like it's an intense conversation, and like the fact that we're actually talking about this photo shoot again, because obviously it came up recently because the Harry Styles cover on Vogue, yep. And the whole like gender fluidity and what means a man, because fucking idiots just want clicks. I'm not talking about the people writing the articles, like is it Candice Owens? Yeah, like, and so it's interesting how this cover really speaks 20 years later, 21 years later.
It really does. It's interesting. I went to see Fight Club. Time is a flat circle right now, so I don't remember when it was, but it was like a year or so ago. And with a friend, a female friend, and at a theater at the New Beverly in Los Angeles. And it was mostly filled with guys. And it was a somewhat uncomfortable experience, if I'm being completely honest. The audience was laughing at things that I was like, this movie is like, this movie was kind of a little bit weaponized by the sort of the MRA, this men rights, you know, movement, this idea. I wish you could all see Tori's face right now. Understandably nauseous by the notion. It's such a poor, stupid reading of this film. And it happened with The Matrix as well. You know, it happened with these movies that are made by unbelievably intelligent writers and filmmakers that are clearly using these as commentaries on things. And it's the whole red pill, blue pill nonsense where it's like, you are making a fucking choice right now to misread this film in such a way. And I think this cover speaks to that as well. I mean, I don't remember there being much of a brouhaha around it at the time, but I imagine someone was like, why is Brad Pitt wearing a dress on the cover of Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I don't remember there being much, actually. There is a bit in the interview, and I can't remember what word it is. I think it's exception, maybe, but he says it in a French accent. And the interviewer like points out, he's like, yeah, he like said it in a French accent. It also mentions his architecture obsession, which gets mentioned in the 94 profile, which is my favorite thing. And I'm like, oh, Brad loves buildings.
See, this is the thing. If Brad doesn't want people to think he's dumb, he should stop saying dumb shit.
Yeah. It's honestly, you should it's great. He talks about turning down a Cameron Crowe role, which is clearly almost famous. It's wonderful.
I mean, I just want to be very clear. I'm a very big Brad Pitt fan. Sure. I don't mean to sit here and sound as though I'm not. I think part of this is media consumption. Part of this is how people are interviewed. I really do understand if you are Brad Pitt, you want to control your narrative. Sure. You want to control the way that you're being perceived. I get all of that. But if you don't want people to take things out of context, you have to stop saying things that in context might make you look bad. That's awesome.
There's a fun point about him talking about winning an Oscar, and he doesn't think he'll win one unless he plays a man up the mountain. And it's like, oh, you won one.
You did it, Brad. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
He gets into an argument about also, what was it? He was saying like this, you know, writing isn't an art. He's like, you're just doing this to like get a rise out of me. And then the interviewer like turns on him. He's like, oh, so what you do is an art? Like, it's just entertainment for you. And they go back and forth about that as well. It's very
it's a
like,
contentious interview.
Honestly, it really is. Like, I think profile writing is actually quite exceptional. Like, I think obviously there are ticks that you have to do like with the what people are wearing. But I think if you're a good profile writer, it's fascinating how it breaks it down.
I mean, that's really interesting because, yeah, I just, it kind of makes me think about Almost Famous because of the whole idea that he's a Rolling Stone writer and that they're scared of how he's going to make them look. You know, it really does kind of fold into those things. And I do understand if you're a famous person, being worried about how things are going to be perceived, something being taken out of context. It's very similar to politics in its own way. I mean, I'm sure that you don't want, but the Almost Famous thing is interesting too, because I don't know that Brad Pitt's right for Russell Hammond as much as I love Brad Pitt. I love Almost Famous, and I think Almost Famous works because there aren't any movie stars in that movie. I do wish I could see the alternate version where Sarah Pauly is Penny Lane. There is a part of me that wishes that I could see that because I think she would have been spectacular in a very different way. But yeah, I mean, Brad Pitt's Brad Pitt, guys. Like, he's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's really, he's another filmography, by the way, that like, if you look at it, when he's like a bona fide movie star, he's, which is, you know, let's be real, basically the 90s and kind of early 2000s, he's still trying to take kind of interesting roles within the sphere of being a leading man. Yeah, I don't know. I think he's, and I think that his work with Fincher is, you know, some of the best work he's ever done. So.
Yeah.
Also on this cover, Christina Aguilera, Tales of Teen Fame, Campaign 2000, John McCain, if only. The Dixie Chicks live Creed and Eve. Jesus Christ. Murderers Row with live Creed and Eve there. I don't know. Our next cover is Nicolas Cage. just being full on Nicolas Cage with his hair dyed a strange color.
Yeah.
I mean, what's there to say that hasn't been said about the passion of Nick Cage as the cover of this article?
I didn't know that his surname, that he took it from Luke Cage. I learned that from this piece, so who knew?
I don't think I knew that either.
Yeah, apparently he took it from Luke Cage, so he really loves comic books.
That's interesting.
Yeah, right.
So Nicolas Cage has an interesting 1999. He makes two very different films. He makes 8mm and Bringing Out the Dead in 1999. We've done episodes on both of these films. I love Bringing Out the Dead. It's one of my favorite Scorsese films. I think it's really, really underrated. And I think he's tremendous in it. I think it works to all of his strengths in terms of his very strange sense of humor and also his innate talents. 8mm is just gonzo on a bunch of weird levels. If, for those who don't know, 8mm is about a guy who's hired to find a snuff film, is given a snuff film and hired to find out who is killed and who killed them. It's a lot. The best Nicolas Cage piece of pop culture recently that I'm sure you guys saw was the picture of him walking down the street with his son dressed up like he's the Penguin.
Yeah.
I love it so much. It makes me so happy.
Yeah.
His son, whose name is Jor-El or Kal-El, sorry.
Yes.
For those who don't know what I'm talking about, just Google Nicolas Cage and son. I'm sure it's the first photo that comes up right now. His son is just wearing a pair of Uggs with like sweat socks and like a swimsuit. And just a t-shirt. And Nicolas Cage is dressed in a full-on top hat and a cane. He's tucked his ears into the hat. I mean, it's gold. It's absolute gold. I love Nicolas Cage. I wish that we got more of him, quite frankly. He deserves a renaissance. I feel like he might get one someday. But okay. What do we think about this t-shirt sort of rolled up past his biceps?
I mean, it's very tired. There's a Ben Affleck cover in 2004, yes. And he's wearing a similar, like, it's more of a vest that he's wearing. Mm-hmm. But there's a similar vibe is what I'm getting, basically.
I would, you know, it's funny you bring up Ben Affleck because I could see Ben Affleck having a similar trajectory. Like, I could see Ben Affleck also walking down the street with a child dressed in Uggs.
Oh, Anna de Armas, maybe. On one of their
Anna de Armas.
On a catwalk.
I mean, we've also, the internet has given us some glorious pictures of Ben Affleck. Just very contemplative.
The memes.
The cigarette ones are just, I mean, the one that comes to mind is him on the beach with the towel wrapped around his belly, just staring out into the ocean. Yeah, with his fucking back to the I love it so much. The thing about Ben Affleck, not to get into Ben Affleck, because we could talk about him for 2 hours alone, but it's like, I think about Jennifer Garner picking him up to drive him to rehab and pulling over to get him fast food along the way. I'm just like, Jen, you're a fucking angel. You deserve so much better than this.
Speaking of magazine profiles, that Vanity Fair when she was like, I refuse to be the ashes. And it's like, fucking yes. I remember I was going to, this is like a quick tangent, I was going to these marriage classes. We had to, like, because my husband's Catholic, and we had to, like, you have to take these classes beforehand, and I'm a Catholic. And I remember, like, that story popping up on my Twitter feed just before we were going in, and I was like, I just need to go to the bathroom. And I literally, like, sat in the bathroom just, like, reading the story. And then he was like, what the fuck took you so long? And I was like, this came out. I need to read this cover.
That's incredible.
So that I read before all the issue arrived, so...
This cover has a lot of text, so I'm going to walk through some of it here. Family Values Tour, Goo Goo Dolls, David Bowie. Rage Against the Machine gets 4 stars on their album. The Allmans, Costellos, Marleys, Wainwrights, Cotters, and Fathers and Sons, I don't know what that is. Campaign 2000, you were absolutely right, Tori. It was Bill Bradley was the other Democratic possible nominee. Gore versus Bradley. Bono goes to Washington to everyone's, I don't know, chagrin, perhaps.
He gave him a free album. Like, he arrived with, like...
Yeah, And then The Secret Life of Teenage Girls.
I read
that. Did anyone read that article?
Yeah.
What's that about?
Actually, the writer I really like, I read her book. She wrote this book about writing for Rolling Stone in 2006. And she's still writing now. She wrote the Elle Fanning cover story for Vanity Fair this year. And actually, I thought it was just basically what teenage girls have always been like. Yeah. And because it was written by a woman, there was nothing mean in it. And it didn't seem like she wasn't like picking them apart. Like there was some dubious language stuff about them using the term gay as a slur. Yes. As people, you know.
Boys, right?
So yeah. So yeah. And like it felt like actually not incendiary. It felt kind of nice. Agree. So it was a win.
Sorry, yelling about like guys I think are hot and just the names are so nice.
Prince William.
Yes, Prince William, Joshua Jackson, Angel from Buffy, and the third rock from the sun guy is what they said.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I guess.
Not French Stewart.
Or John Lithgow? Wow, that's great. So our second to last issue that we'll talk about, there's two at the end we can breeze over, but we have two more. Rage Against the Machine on the front cover, the mightiest band in rock. We did an episode on Rage Against the Machine with past and future guest Rich Monahan. I don't know a ton about Rage Against the Machine. I learned a lot about it in that episode. They're a fascinating band. They started something that I bet they wish they didn't, which is sort of like, what's the best way to describe it? It's like bands like Korn kind of come out of Rage Against the Machine. So like that kind of rap rock, white rap rock thing. And they are a very powerful band, very politically motivated. They're fucking great. And it's interesting that this is basically their last album. They have an album in 99 and that's essentially the end of the road. They break up shortly thereafter. But it's great that they got a cover. I'm not sure it's the best cover of the world. I think they're in front of something on fire.
The world.
It's not even close to being on fire yet. It's going to take another 20 years for that to happen.
Yeah. I don't love it.
I don't love it. Like it's not great. Yeah. It looks photoshopped a little bit. Like it looks like they've been cropped into something. It's not a great cover, unfortunately. No. Beck, Foo Fighters, Fiona Apple also on this cover, and the Uncensored History of the Allman Brothers. Sure. What everyone was looking for in 1999. And now we have Christina Ricci. Is in the, I guess, the cover of November's issue. Nice and Naughty, Christina Ricci. I'm trying to think, and I'm going to look this up very quickly here. What is she doing in 1999?
Shooting Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, right. She's in. How did I not know that? That makes me feel real dumb. Well, she's not shooting it. She releases it.
Sure, so that's but what comes it's on, that's I think done. Some of it's on the set, right? They're filming it, I feel like. Yes, in the, so it's a set visit.
Yeah, and she's in 200 Cigarettes as well. That's the other movie that she's in 99. I knew she was in something else. Yeah, you know, the problem was I just never think she's in Sleepy Hollow. The hair and the whatever, it just doesn't even... Anyway. So yeah, of course, she has that coming out momentarily or shortly around this issue. Rich Geek, Poor Geek, Down and Out in Silicon Valley.
I read that.
How is that?
It's basically just like, you know, in Silicon Valley, there's obviously a huge population of incredibly rich people. And then the rest of the people are all incredibly poor. So it's just like the disparity in class in Silicon Valley is what it's about.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Clinton, Clapton, Kravitz, and Crow backstage at the White House. Those are definitely four people that played during Clinton's administration at the White House. With no offense to Eric Clapton, Lenny Kravitz, or Sheryl Crow, but that's a moment right there. Dr. Dre returns, Beck parties, Creed live, Dead Box. I'm assuming it's Grateful Dead.
Oh, okay. I was confused by that. I was like, I don't understand who that is.
I'm assuming that's what that is.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And then Andy, there's some sort of an Andy Kaufman article as well here, it seems. Sure. Christina Ricci, I've always loved Christina Ricci. I think she's great. You know, it's interesting how, like, so I was on a podcast called Screen Drafts, where you draft certain sort of groups of films, is I guess the best way to describe it. And I was on there for Winona Ryder, which I went on with Dana Schwartz to talk about Winona Ryder. I guess argue about Winona Ryder is the better way of putting it. But all that being said, it does feel like Christina Ricci tries to kind of become Winona Ryder a little bit. Like that there are similarities in their kind of trajectories and in kind of the image they give off a little bit. Do you think is that a fair assessment?
It gets brought up, the Johnny Depp stuff in this interview, like, which is a sure. very odd situation. Cause she's talking about how she had a crush on him when they did Mermaids, and obviously she was quite young. So yeah. It's like that weird juxtaposition again.
See, like, that's the type of thing that if I'm working in PR, I'm thinking, don't ask them about this, because all you're doing is making Johnny Depp look like a fucking creep for kissing her in Sleepy Hollow. Like, the age discrepancy is severe. So there's that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's another case of, like, the fact the cover lines are nice and naughty. Like, they love the Madonna whore, basically. Like, unless it's Angelina Jolie and they're just basically like, show us your tats, which also happens in that place.
Hollywood likes the Madonna. I think that's a broader accusation, which is fair. I think she's had and continues to have a really fascinating career. I don't know. Wednesday Addams, man. Like, you're never gonna. It's just fucking best. It's just she's great. So these last two covers, which we'll breeze through really quickly here. They did some sort of a best records of 99 kind of special photo issue of some sort. Were there photos worth mentioning in this? Did you guys look at this one?
Okay. Not.
And then the very last one is the Millennium issue, where it's a special issue about the fucking Millennium. I guess what's going to happen, guys? It's going to be the year 2000. And the spoiler is nothing happens. It's the same as the day before. By and large, first of all, this was a blast, and I can't thank you guys enough for doing this episode, obviously. But I thought that this, like, what I found fascinating about this, recording this episode and looking at the issues before it, were sort of, it really does capture these bite-sized little moments of the entire year in a way that kind of nothing else that we've covered on this show or on this podcast really has up until this point, because we don't, generally speaking, get that much of a 30,000 feet perspective on the entire year. So it was really great to kind of like pop into these issues and be able to sort of, and when I say issues, I mean, I guess both versions, issues and the actual physical issues. But I hope you guys had a good time. Did anything sort of jump out at you that sort of an overarching kind of vibe that you got from this from 99 through Rolling Stone?
I'm Biscuit.
Mark McGrath.
Oh, God damn it. So the two worst things you could take from 99.
I think it's reinforced that it was like quite an incredible year, where there are still things that we're still referencing and all still people who are obviously very much at their peak. Well, not at their peak necessarily, but they're still like A-list. Like,
yeah, it's funny you say that. You know, it's been 20 years, and most of the people that got these covers still have careers.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, it's just interesting. I'm sort of surprised that you look at all of these covers and you think, like, I'm surprised there aren't more flameouts, I guess. You know what I mean? That there aren't more people with careers
and like
cratered.
I know I sent you that John Travolta picture, the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, yeah,
the reason why I wanted to mention it is because if you ever see, I mean, this is just because I love magazines, but like in shots, especially of period stuff, if there are magazines in the background, I will like freeze it to see what they are. Like when I went to see Call Me By Your Name, like I took note in my head that that was a John Travolta cover because I wanted to like see what if they got it accurate. Yeah, it's like, and the Americans use the Warren Beatty cover in the second season finale, like stuff like that. Like, I just love that kind of cultural touchstone, and you get that from a magazine cover. Like, you're like, right, this was that like month.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's great. But yeah, John Travolta. Yeah, look at that.
It's interesting how like I actually think that. I mean, for those who want to see it, yeah, it's a very. It's a very sinewy version of John Travolta.
Yeah.
But I think to your point a little bit too, that the monthly issues tend to, I don't know if this is the right word, but be a little bit more powerful than your weeklies. You know what I mean? It's like when I see like a People magazine or an Entertainment Weekly magazine, as much as I might like those magazines, when they pop up in various pieces of pop culture, they don't have the same power that that something that comes out only 12 times a year, give or take. But
yeah. And I think it's just an interesting, and I don't know if we're going to have that so much anymore because obviously the way digital and print is going. But yeah, it's a nice little touchstone.
It is unfortunate that it feels like those things are starting to go away, but I mean, we'll see.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on here to talk about this stuff with me. This was an absolute blast, and I really hope that you'll both come back for something else in the future.
Yes. No, this is wonderful. Thank you.
So, of course. So before you guys log out, you can close the Zoom, but keep the Zencastr window open so that can upload. Okay. And then we'll send out an email when we can all close our browsers.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'd love to have you guys come back. I was wondering if you'd be interested in coming back to talk about costume design, like the best costumes of 1999. Is that something that would be like from film?
I mean, I would love that.
Yeah.
Tori, is that something you'd be interested in?
Yeah.
I would 100% love that.
Okay. So if what I'm sort of doing is I do sort of these episodes off to the side with episodes that Kenny just, quite frankly, doesn't give a shit about. So that's fine. This is prerogative. But yeah, why don't we like, if you're cool aiming for like mid to late January or early February or something like that?
Sure. So yeah, just film costumes of 99 that were iconic. Just
movie costumes from 1999.
I can do that.
Yeah. And just sort of, yeah, because I feel like you guys are tapped into sort of, I hate to say this, but fashion, but like just in terms of like that sort of aesthetic. And I want to kind of try to when I can hone in on different below the line departments of the different sort of from 99. So
we can do some embarrassing things that I try to dress up as.
Oh, yes.
Which I definitely did. So
no, I mean, I honestly think that people don't think enough about the various departments
Make up
filmmaking. They don't think about cinematography. They don't think about costume design or production design or these various things. So I think this is an opportunity. And I think that there are a lot of – I think the unfortunate misnomer about costume design is period pieces.
The
only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think about the costumes in Eyes Wide Shut, for instance, or, you know what I mean, even American Beauty, you know, putting the quality of these films aside necessarily, sure. Like bad films can have amazing costume design and great films can have kind of lousy costume design. So,
and contemporary does get kind of fucked over a lot. So I am,
it really,
it's does. My favorite. Contemporary is my favorite. So,
and it's an opportunity for us to talk more about Fight Club and its costume design.
Yeah.
Yes. So
there you go. Thank you so much guys for coming out.
Thank you. That. This has been excellent.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.